We've arrived in Oslo. Brian and I have arrived. We've actually come from the UK. We just got a plane because the UK has opened up some of its air space for various reasons. It looks like our infection rates are low. The last time I tried to go to Oslo, I actually took a plane to Stockholm by mistake. And I've got three or four great taxi ride stories in my life. And one of the great taxi ride stories was arriving at the airport saying, I want to go to Oslo.
I think I remember that.
Yeah, that was one of the other. I've been one or two. There's also been a Munich to Budapest story, but I can't talk too much about the detail of that.
All right, Tom, move on.
We're here today and we're talking to Jan, and we're going to talk about a disease we've not talked about before, which is testis cancer. And it's been somewhat ignored by Brian and myself on our podcast. And Jan, we're delighted to be here. We start many of these podcasts by either going to a bar or a restaurant. We've decided to go to a bar in Oslo. Jan, if you first would like to introduce yourself, then you'd like to tell us where you're going to take us out for a beer. And then we're going to ask you some questions.
Happy. Great. My name is Jan Oldenburg. I'm actually German, living in Norway for about 20 years. Have been working a lot on testicular cancer. Did a lot research on long-term toxicity and treatment. I'm the first author of the ESMO guidelines and testicular cancer. I really like this.
And what about the bar? What about the bar?
The bar, because I think you would appreciate something typical Norwegian, right?
Well, yes, definitely.
Yes,
definitely. So alcohol is a bit problematic in Scandinavia. So you can't buy a bottle of wine in the supermarket. It's from something like, it's a pharmacy, like it's a Vin Monopole. So to have something typical in Norwegian, I would invite you to our cantina in the hospital, and then we have a marpakke. So everybody brings their own food.
Oh, that does sound terrific, actually.
It's very time efficient for the hospitals, of course. Yeah, because it's no queuing. You just have your food, and then you have a glass of water, and after 15 minutes you're back. So this is
sounds good. Look, the first question I wanted to ask about. I'm gonna jump through some topics. I wanted to talk about some of the controversial treatment issues in testis cancer. So stage one seminoma and non-seminoma remains an area of controversy around adjuvant therapy. Where does it currently sit in the ESMO guidelines?
So actually, we're working on it. So I think you have to disentangle a high risk and low risk stage one. Ideally, you could say it's treatment of testicular cancer is really, really easy. If it's stage one, you just remove the testicle, you do nothing more. If it's metastatic disease, you give 3 to 4 BEP. And then we could stop our podcast right now.
That sounds excellent.
But, yeah.
go to that bar.
Because
some
have
suggested
some,
that.
Some recommendation for bars, of course, as well. But it's more complicated for the stage one. That's by far the most frequent presentation. It's for seminoma. It's 50-50 seminoma, non-seminoma, approximately. And the seminoma patients, about 80% have stage one. And the risk of metastasis is quite low, and it's lower than a non-seminoma, which tends to be a bit more aggressive. And also the non-seminoma patients are about 10 years younger than the seminoma patients. So non-seminoma would be 20 to 30 years, and seminoma more 30, 40 years. But after removal of the testicle, you need a really experienced pathologist, because it's quite a variation of histologies in testicular cancer, because these germ cells, they can become everything, of course. So you might have teratoma, you might have Yorksek. But the essential thing is, if you have vascular invasion and non-seminoma, I would strongly consider adjuvant chemotherapy with 1.5 BEP.
And you may have just said this, what's your current adjuvant regimen? One of BEP?
Yeah, one BEP.
One cycle.
And that's for the non-seminomas and for the seminomas?
For the seminomas, it's really intriguing. There's an ongoing trial here in Norway and Sweden. It's a Svinotika, the Swedish-Norwegian Testicular Cancer Group. they're randomizing stage one seminoma between one cycle of carboplatin, it's about 30 minutes, versus one cycle of BP, which of course is a week, and then you have these bleomycin infusions. And the hope is, or the expectation is, that the risk of relapse is much lower after BP. But of course, toxicity will be increased as well.
But Jan, why not just do nothing?
Because if you have if you look at the numbers to treat for high risk non-seminoma, it's about 50% of patients will have a relapse.
Yeah, that means 50% don't need any chemotherapy.
That's right. So you do harm to 50% of patients, and I think you help 50% of patients, because the risk after one BEP is about 2-3%. It's really low.
Yeah, but Jan, you're giving BEP when you relapse, so it's either BEP for everyone up front or BEP for 50% when they relapse.
That's completely right.
It's a different amount
Tom,
of BEP.
But then you are ignoring the numbers. It's one BEP versus 3-4 BEP when you relapse. And this is a big difference.
Yeah. Okay. Tom ignores numbers all the time.
Yeah, but the principle is right, of course. It's BEP for everybody. And I mean, the big question is, how do we avoid unnecessary treatment? And I completely concur, Tom. I do not like to give chemotherapy to people who do not have micrometastases.
Jan, tell me about the seminoma patients now. There was an issue around radiotherapy in the past. There was the issue about single-agent carboplatin monotherapy, and obviously the issue around surveillance. Where do you sit?
I think for seminoma, it's you do not do a big mistake if you surveillance people, because the risk of relapse is much lower. And also, if you have the radiotastus invasion or the tumor, primary tumor, bigger than 3 or 4 centimeters, the risk is higher, but it's not as high as high risk non-seminoma. The treatment would be...
Jan, I want to...
So are there any seminoma patients that you give adjuvant therapy to then?
Yeah.
Or do you observe everybody?
No, that, if it's a small tumor, primary tumor without radiotastus invasion, the recommendation is surveillance.
Right.
Almost everybody agrees here. If it's a high risk, if it's a big tumor, and in addition, radiotastus invasion, I would think 30 minutes carboplatin.
So, okay. Two risk factors then. Both risk factors.
And Jan, does anyone get a retroperitoneal lymph node dissection?
It's very few, Tom. So I think we have some patients who have a pure teratoma, and sometimes even somatic transformation. And this is really tricky. So you need experienced pathologists to identify this. And this teratoma on malignant transformation, they would not respond to chemotherapy and you would not give radiotherapy. So here it would be surgery. Absolutely.
Jan, I'm going to move from stage one all to the other extreme, to second line metastatic. Let's assume a patient's had 4 cycles of BEP for a non-seminomatous germ cell tumor. And they relapse 8 months later in the lungs. What's the standard treatment globally?
It's a salvage treatment. It's you have the believers and the non-believers. You have the believers in high-dose chemotherapy. They absolutely would give high-dose chemotherapy, of course. And then you have people who think, no, it's not really proven that it is better than conventional chemotherapy. And this is right. It's a big dilemma. And Tom, you contributed a big to this area by organizing the Tiger trial, or contributing to organizing the Tiger trial.
Yeah, well, lots of people involved. In fact, Darren Feltman leads that study, so I'm not leading that trial.
Yeah, but you were one of the guys in the beginning, I remember.
Might have a chance of being successful.
That's very, very amusing, Brian. That's very amusing.
Yeah, but then you would randomize patients to 4 TEP cycles, where there's high-dose chemotherapy. And it took a lot of time to start. Yeah,
I learned more from that trial than any study I've ever done.
Why is that?
I can't begin to explain. We have a podcast on the Tiger trial. We'll get Darren involved one day.
Okay,
the setting up of the Tiger trial was extraordinary. But Jan, but so what do you pick? Are you picking conventional? Obviously, with the exception of the trial, and if you're taking part of the trial, that's great. But if you had to select therapy for these patients, where are you a believer in high-dose therapy? And could you just give me a summary of the data? If you could give me a summary of the argument for the believers and a summary of the argument for the non-believers for our audience, that would be great.
Yeah, for the believers, you have randomized trials, which also have the same problems like the Tiger trial recruitment was really poor. And these studies, none of these were fully recruited. So, but the tendency is that the PFS is better after high-dose chemotherapy.
So these are randomized trials that have previously been done of conventional versus high-dose therapy.
Right.
And the issues with those trials are the number of high-dose cycles that were given and whether or not TICE, which is the regime given in Tiger, is the best regime in inverted commas. And there seems to be, is it fair to say, Jan, that there is a real debate about which regime to give and whether the number of high dose cycles to give and whether or not it's better?
Yeah, it's that's fair to say, Tom. But still, I think high dose chemotherapy, it's a different class than conventional chemotherapy. So I think the Tiger is really, it's the biggest and the most important trial we are awaiting results for our testicular cancer.
What treatment do you give, Jan? Do you give conventional or do you give high dose therapy?
It depends. I like high dose chemotherapy, so I would refer patients for high dose, actually.
So what's the argument? I don't think we got the argument for the non-believers in the high-dose therapy. For those who don't give it, what's their rationale?
The rationale would be that it's not shown to be superior. If you do evidence-based medicine, and I think we all should do that, there's not really good evidence. There's a lot of circumstantial data that
The randomized trials, Brian, have not shown a survival advantage. They've been done, but to date they've been underpowered, or there's only been one. There's been one high-dose cycle, and so some people believe that the Indiana regime that Larry Einhorn gives, that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, that has great results, had that been tested, that would have ended up being a positive trial. And then, of course, there's the TICE regime, and then more recently, TIP came along as a conventional therapy, and so the whole thing has become just very complicated, and it's one of the areas that really divides us. Jan, what's your advice to the community oncologists who are treating a bit of testis cancer, who have an individual who's relapsed? What's the right thing to do?
It's a great question, Tom. So this is the answer almost everybody gives: refer to an expert center, because it's so difficult. Often, sometimes it's after 15 years, surgery is often underestimated for the success of treating these patients. So quite often it's teratoma, which might be growing 15 years after chemo. So it would be horribly to give high-dose chemotherapy to teratoma patients. So these should be surgically cured. And that's often not very, very complicated. But of course, you need experienced oncologists, you need really good radiologists, you need pathologists, you need urologic surgeons. You need the whole team to manage these patients optimally.
So, Tom, can we move to long-term complications? Yeah, so Jan, you've done a lot of work with long-term complications in these young patients who fortunately are very often cured. Do you want to talk about your research in that, or sort of the latest and the greatest in terms of how these patients should be surveilled long-term and what some of the risks are?
Yeah, thank you. I would like to start to say that I had a dinner once with Larry Einhorn, who told that it was not only sensitivity.
Did you take him to your hospital like you, me, and Brian? Or did you go to a nice restaurant?
Yeah. He took him somewhere nice.
He was at my hospital, at the Radom Hospital, but we had a lovely dinner at the Fondasator. You have a view about the whole city.
Yeah.
Was nice wine and was excellent food. And he told me that cisplatin saved a lot of testicular cancer patients. Of course, we know that, but the testicular cancer patients also saved cisplatin, because it's only the young who would tolerate cisplatin. It's so highly emetogenic, and you need really good kidney function. If you would have tried this drug at lung cancer, you would never have succeeded. Hmm. This drug would never have been out in clinical studies now. And
that's interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So, yeah. But there's a lot of damage by cisplatin or by other drugs as well. So you usually have etoposide, you have bleomycin, and you have cisplatin. It's the Indiana regimen. And this is a standard of care for almost all patients with metastatic cancer. Now, it's amazing that this regimen established in the 80s still is ruling.
Right.
So there were a lot of trials competing against 3-4 BEP. It was not until Karim Fizasi had an intensification course for really poor risk patients. But the long-term results, we had a study where in Norway, everybody who was treated for testicular cancer was invited to participate in a long-term survey about 10 years after treatment. And we could see that some soft toxicities like neuropathy, renal phenomenon, poor hearing, tinnitus, they were really frequent.
How frequent?
I think it's about every third patient has a major wow. problems.
And Jan, talk to me wow. about cardiovascular disease and second cancers.
Yeah, these are the two killers. These are the serious long-term tox. They are increased. They are increased after, you could say about doubled after radiotherapy and about doubled after chemotherapy. If you give both radio and chemotherapy, which we are not doing so much right now, it's about threefold risk of a second cancer. And it's for the cardiovascular system, it's very similar. Also, radiotherapy has systemic side effects for the cardiovascular system.
So do these, for the primary care docs, these folks should presumably get enhanced cancer screening? What's their cardiovascular management like? Is it different than the general population?
Yeah, and then you would, as I told in the beginning, the most common presentation now is stage one. And then it's difficult. Should these patients get 3-4 BEP after being survived, after orchiectomy, or would you like to decrease the risk of receiving systemic BEP times 3-4 by preventing the metastases? I think it's a really, really difficult question to answer.
Yeah, and let me just dive in. So I'm aware that some institutions in the US try and avoid bleomycin if they can for lung toxicity, and they're giving 4 cycles of EP rather than 3 cycles of BET. Is that because of the same issue, the lung toxicity? And talk to me about the long-term sequelae of bleomycin lung toxicity in this young population.
I think 4-BEP is a good compromise, but I think the toxicity of bleomycin is often overestimated. So if you have a good renal function, if you are not smoking, if you're not really an older patient, I would stick to 3-BEP.
So you think we should not be avoiding bleomycin because of the lung toxicity, and if patients request it, they should be advised that it's the wrong thing to do? In your opinion?
Yes.
Okay, that's very clear.
Yes. Yeah. So when you look at fatigue, which is a really common side effect of almost every cancer treatment we give, it increases, is much higher than in the normal population in 10 years after testicular cancer treatment. And the interesting thing is it is increasing further. If you look 20 years after treatment, same patient, the risk of fatigue is about doubled.
Yang, question for you. Let's say I'm appointed to a new job. I get fired in my new post, my current post, which is quite like, which is likely after this podcast, because they
likely.
Know how little I know seems about likely. Testicular cancer. And I take on a new practice down the road, and I start a new clinic, and that clinic is a long-term cohort of testis cancer survivors who are seen every year. And let's say I've got a group of patients after 7 years of follow-up who really had very little advice other than the chemotherapy advice they've had in the past. Should I be doing, what tests should I be doing on them? Should I be measuring their cholesterol, measuring their blood pressure? Should I be doing colonoscopies? What should I be doing for that cohort of patients 10 years after testis cancer treatment?
Yeah, it's a window of opportunity to change. It's lifestyle modification you could speak about. And we actually see that people stop smoking if they are told or repeatedly told to do so by oncologists. And smoking is probably as bad as having received chemotherapy. So if you do both, you will get problems after some time. Risk factors like high blood pressure, of course, that should be normalized. Training is it's so easy. You should. The Scandinavians are doing a lot of skiing and cycling. So for these, it might work. But it's a lot to get out of some daily workout. That would be my advice. And then fish. Eat vegetables and fish, and not too much alcohol.
So it's really about lifestyle modifications.
It really is, yeah.
Tom, I'm not sure you're the best person to be giving that advice.
No, certainly not. What I have got for you, Jan, is one of my first studies, randomized trials, I did a quality of life questionnaire, which I got from Norway. And in that questionnaire, one of the questions directly was asked was about how much wood chopping and skiing you did. Like, this study I tried to push into East London, and all the patients came back and said, well, I've never been skiing, Tom, and number one. Why wood chopping? Anyway.
Lost in translation. Yeah.
Anyway. So we've got to keep going. We're going to thank you very much for this really fantastic time that you've given us. We're actually on our way to Boston. And how do we get from Oslo to Boston these days?
Oh, do you like jet lag or do you not?
We can deal with it.
Ship would be a good way to get there.
Not a cruise ship.
No, cruise ship.
Any cruise ship could last anywhere between 3 days and 40 days.
You could be working on deck. You could be working on deck of an oil tank.
Yeah, and thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jan.
And we're going to see each other super soon.
Yeah, I hope so.
Cheers.
Thank you very much.
All right. Take care.
Bye, Tom.